This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Rajoshi Gupta, the head of AI at Avast.
Good morning. I did my PhD in EECS from Berkeley, and I spent many years at Qualcomm Research, where I worked on machine learning for security. For the last couple of years, I've been at Avast, heading up AI for security purposes in the company, and it's a very exciting challenge to use the latest AI techniques for defense.
Barely a week goes by that a new security company doesn't appear, and the first thing they say is, we've got AI. It's going to make you secure from any attack that's not even been thought of yet. But the problem here is, what does AI actually mean for cybersecurity? Because when we look at other domains, it just means a better way to process vast amounts of information.
That's a great point. To give credit where it's due, many of the companies that are coming up right now do use AI at various forms. The important thing to realize, as you just mentioned, is the fact that AI and the quality of the AI model is highly dependent on the quality of the data that you feed into it. It's not just the quantity of the data, but the diversity of the data. If you build a model with very large amounts of diverse data, you will have a good model. If you build a model with smaller amounts of not so diverse data, you will not have a good model. This is where companies like us, who have a large number of client base. In our case, we have data from about 300 million PCs and 150 million mobile devices. This 450 million numbers of client which feeds us data makes our models very, very diverse. And that is what helps our AI to get to the proper qualities.
When we look at the history of early AIs in cybersecurity, one of the challenges has been, how do we clean the model if the model gets dirty? How do we avoid the risk of false positives being seen by the system over time as being an absolute?
Yes, I think those are two separate questions, and they're both great questions. I'll answer them separately. First of all, security is a very unique field of AI. Because of all the advancements of AI that you see in recent times, they're mostly in the area of image recognition, video, audio, natural language processing, and the one I love the most is self-driving cars. But none of these cases do you ever have an adversary or a target who is trying to evade the system. It's only in our field of security where we have the challenge of trying to detect something which is trying to hide from us. That makes it hard. And that's why AI in the field of security is unique. We need models that are much more adaptable than all the other fields. In those other fields, it's okay to create and release a new model once a month or once a quarter. In our case, we need models to be trained and deployed much, much faster. That itself is the answer to why it's important to contain or not let the models go stale, because you need a system where you're updating the model very fast. So the staleness problem is less so, because our underlying characteristics or the underlying physics of the system is such that we need to be rapidly adaptable. The second question you asked was about false positives. And false positives is indeed a big issue. The term false positives originally came from the field of detecting missiles. Over there, the cost of a false negative was very bad because you'd get blown up. The cost of a false positive was much lower because you thought you got something and you investigated and you let go of it. In our field of security, unfortunately, the cost of a false positive is pretty high, because if you miss a malware, it can do a certain amount of harm. But if you miss and you misclassify a good app or a good file as bad, then you can have problems like press, you can have problems like lawsuits. So the systems are pushed to the edge, where in normal terms, in the technical term being the ROC curve, we typically work in the domain where the false positive rates are well below 1%. That's a challenge. Because as any ML practitioner knows, you're always trading off false positives with false negatives, and we are forced to be in the very low false positive domain, and that's one of the challenges that we are needed to solve.
How do you bring the two together? If you're going to have a high velocity of models, which means a lot of change, there becomes a challenge in distributing those models. If we look at signature-based systems, they might update two or three times a day, but what they're updating is a very small amount of information going out. When we typically think of an AI model, it's very large. If we've got to be very careful about the pollution of the model with false positives, that in most people's minds would argue against the high velocity of change. How are you bringing that together?
What you're pointing out is actually a fairly interesting trade-off between a client-based system and a cloud-based system. In a client-based system, it is absolutely correct that it's very difficult to update models very frequently. But many companies, like ours, the primary AI models are running in the cloud. So what we are updating at the clients are some very small deltas, or when we identify something in the cloud, we're actually sending them some features about the new file that can be detected on the client. But the real heavy-duty models that are deployed are in the cloud, so to refresh it multiple times a day is not as much of an issue.
When we talk about size of this data and the diversity of data, you talked about hundreds of millions of endpoints sending information back. How do you pre-process that data? Do you bring it into one location before you start to act? Do you use edge computing to say, okay, I've got 50 million endpoints over there. They've all seen that same attack. First of all, do I need to send 50 million copies, or do I send one copy with a significant weighting to say that this is a really important attack, whereas the next set of data, maybe we've only seen a little bit of it?
In reality, what happens is that the life cycle of an attack starts when the attack or the file is seen for the first time by somebody somewhere in the world. When the thing is seen from the first time, the person or that machine actually asks the cloud, have you seen this before? Except for the first time or except for the first few times, the answer is yes, we have seen it before. We know that it's okay, or we know that it's bad. It's just a direct single lookup, and that can be done extremely, extremely fast. And the whole scalability of the things comes from the fact that you want 90, 95, or 99% of the answers to be just a lookup because it's very cheap. All the work that my team does and all the heavy-duty lifting that we do is to solve that last bit, which is what happens when we haven't seen the file. Over there, it's typically a staged approach. The first thing you do is you ask. If you don't get an answer, you extract some features on the computer itself or on the phone itself. And then you try to run a model based on the new features that you have seen, either on the phone or on the cloud. But it's a small model, which is very quick. If that works, we're good. If that doesn't work, then the next version is to run the program in a little virtual machine, a contained virtual machine, on the client device itself, see what it's doing, and then make a judgment. If even that doesn't work, in the ultimate case, we put the file into quarantine. We upload the entire file with the user's permission back to the cloud, where we do all the heavy-duty analysis to make a judgment call. The way this scales is that, say, it takes 10 minutes or 15 minutes for the file to get completely analyzed. During that time, we've quarantined on one machine. At the end of that, when we realize that it's a bad file, we actually update all our clients within 6 minutes. So the total time that this malware has to spread around is maybe the first 20 minutes. And we get all our users to block it. And this is the worst case. In most cases, you catch it in a matter of seconds. And then when you realize that it's a new attack or you see many people getting hit with the attack, then you quickly send out the behavioral signature to block it.
Protecting end user clients is something we've been doing for a very long time. And AI has changed that game, as you say, substantially. The more interesting use of AI to many people is how we use it from a security researcher perspective. The ability of the AI to pull together not just the information from these endpoint clients, but to pull information together from vast numbers of logs, from SIEM systems, from seemingly unrelated locations, and then assist a security researcher in drilling down and identifying. How do we begin to do that in such a way where we can clearly identify what's been found, how it's been found, but then deal with the question of ethics of that data?
It's a great question. There's actually two questions hidden in there. The first one was about the use of logs from many different places. And I want to highlight that's actually the single biggest difference between consumer security and enterprise security. In enterprise security, it's all about working with a dozen, two dozen different security software and collating the data from all of them. In the client endpoint security, we are almost always playing a lone hand. We are the only people playing the brass and the fiddle and the drums. In the consumer space, all the data we have is pretty much what we are gathering from the machine itself, and we have to make our judgment based on that. While we don't really have that quote-unquote problem that you mentioned, unfortunately, the knowledge that we have to go with is also limited. Now, the second piece of that which you mentioned is very interesting. How do you manage the ethics of the AI and the data that you are generating? And in fact, it has been shown in the past that with enough amount of data, where there is some PII in one of those databases somewhere, it's always possible with smart algorithms to collate them together. Always realize that even if you think something is anonymized today, a new algorithm might come out next month which makes it de-anonymized. The key trend which the industry is going is to have fairly strict rules about, first, don't put PII. But of course, we can't manage your Facebook feed, or we can't manage your address book and phone book. So therefore, what you are left with is minimize the PIIs there, but also deal with deleting the data after the immediate thing is over. There are both governmental and industry practices about deleting the data that we have gathered after you've finished analyzing them. We deal with that all the time. You know, we have people's phone records, or we have people's location, and we run models to realize certain things about the population, but then we get rid of the data so that they don't sit there for other algorithms to run.
It's a very complicated problem. It sounds very easy when you put it like that, because you're dealing with so much data from so many sources. And actually, part of the ability to detect an attack is not just that the attack pops up fully formed and shouting, "Here I am." It's that often there are tiny little indicators that can occur over a period of time, particularly if it's an APT. How do you trade off between the need to hold a deep set of data that enables you to pick up trends, enables you to spot hidden attacks, even an attack that's in stealth mode for long periods of time, and that balance between what we shouldn't keep?
That's a very good question, because you don't know what you shouldn't keep. That's a very simple logic. Now, you also mentioned the term APTs, and realize that I was mentioning that what you said is absolutely correct, but it's more applicable in an industrial setting, or when somebody is trying to break into a very specific person's NSA profile or something, and they're willing to wait 6 months and be dormant for 6 months to do it. The consumer security is primarily trying to protect the device that you are on, and maybe the devices around you in your home. This is really not an APT solution. The description about APT is completely correct. You look at SIMs and you look at logs and so on. As I mentioned, in most cases, we don't have access to any logs beyond what's on the machine. We are typically trying to detect the kinds of attacks that are much broader. An APT is a very sustained, directed attack on a particular person. Our software is a much broad-based, and it looks at trend across many machines. An APT is specifically hard to detect because it's unique and it's going after one particular plant, or it's going after one particular company. Our focus or our goal is to detect and look at the trends when an attack is spreading or it's targeting many, many people. And the techniques are quite different, actually. So it's not the way of looking at many logs over many months. It's looking at many computers over a short period of time to detect these kinds of attacks.
How do you shift from protecting endpoint devices such as a computer or a mobile phone or a tablet, where you have an operating system onto which you can install software, to protecting that vast and ever-growing set of consumer IoT? Because there's no storage here into which you can put a client. There's no easy way to extract information back from them. But the AI must give you some idea of the sort of attacks that are beginning to grow in the core of the network, and to maybe begin to give people indicators of risk.
The problem of IoT security is something that we feel very strongly about, and it's the one I answer when the usual question is, what keeps you up at night? I do worry about that. It's true for all the reasons that you mentioned, that we have no visibility into the devices. In secure devices, they're all connected, they're all reachable, and we have no security on it. So those are all the problems. The good thing is that most IoT devices have a behavior that is very structured and repetitive. If you ask an AI person, what are your two favorite words? Those come up pretty high on the list: structured and repetitive. Because the behavior is structured and repetitive, it's easier to model. And because it's easier to model, it's easier to identify the anomalies. And that is what we base everything upon. We look at what those devices are doing on the network. I would love to see what the light bulb is doing. Is it shining too bright or not? But those sensors are too hard. The only sensor that we have in our disposal today is the ability to look at what packets they are sending on the network. And that is what we analyze. The basic technique is traffic analysis. We look at how many packets, what size, how often, what's the burstiness, who are they talking to, and all of this thing. But the interesting piece is that we analyze the traffic in conjunction with an analysis of the infrastructure. We look at what kind of a network are you on? What kind of a device is it in? And that's very important in machine learning. The most high-value feature of anomaly detection for IoTs is what type of a device is it. If you can reliably identify the fact that this is a light bulb, or even better, this is a Philips Hue light bulb, then the idea is, because you have seen 50,000 other Philips Hue light bulbs, and you know what they behave like and what kind of activity they have. If you all of a sudden see a video stream emanating out of a Philips Hue light bulb, that's a very big anomaly. This is the way we detect. We look at what kind of a network it is, what kind of a device it is, and by doing that, you have a model of what their normal traffic pattern should be, and you identify the anomalies.
If we think about that consumer IoT, we're seeing it in offices, from fridges to televisions to video conferencing equipment. We can capture that network traffic at that point. When we just start to talk about the user's home, that traffic from these devices isn't flowing through their PC. It's not flowing through that software point where we can grab a log, we can start to do analytics. How do we use the AI to expand our fingers into those places? Because that's where the hackers are beginning to infect machines that then go into offices.
That's exactly right. And in order to build this AI or in order to make this AI be effective, we need to see the traffic from the homes. Our generation of smart home solution that's coming out this year has a couple of different ways by which we can see that. One is a little device that connects to the router in your home and is able to see the traffic that flows through. The other is a collaboration with partners in the telco space who own the router in the home, where we can put a little software layer on the router, which is also able to see and block the traffic. So your question is absolutely correct. That's just a networking problem. You cannot get around it. You have to see the traffic, and that's what we are doing.
Where does AI go from here? Because we can see how we use it as a security researcher. It refines data. It gives me a set of targets or a route down which I'm going to invest my time. We can see how we can push information faster to endpoints or devices that are able to capture that. But we're always responding to the attack. We're never in this industry ahead of the attack. Can AI shift this game away from the bad guys and towards us?
Yes. We are not there yet. But that is exactly the promise that the AI is giving today, that with enough learning and enough data, we should be able to detect the unknown threats. Since we were talking about IoT just a second ago, the biggest IoT attack that has happened in the last couple of years was the Mirai botnet. To build an AI model that detects the Mirai botnet and any of its 15 variations is really easy. We built a model, it detects Mirai, it detects all of these things. But that's easy because you know what the attack looks like. A much better challenge or a much more intellectually better challenge is to be able to detect the attack when you don't know what the attack looks like. And that is exactly what the AI is geared to do. Learn from a large number of data points even when you don't know what it is. I'll give an example from another space. Last year, we published a paper at this conference called ICLR, which is one of the AI conferences, where we were trying to, this was a research experiment, where we were trying to build an AI detection model where the features that we fed into the system was the binary bits of the file. Imagine we took several million files, we cut off and took the first 650 kilobytes of the file, and then we just took those files and we gave it just the binary bits. And then we asked the deep neural net to figure out the features. To our pleasant surprise, the deep neural net does surprisingly well by just understanding the patterns literally from the bits. This is very different. Those features are very expensive. They take much longer to compute than our normal handwritten features. But the very interesting thing was the fact that you could actually do it. And the same research has been done in a couple of other places around the world. And the industry is realizing that there is enough entropy in the bits itself that you can do it. The same thing works in the IoT world. You give enough flows and you don't have to tell the model, look for these flows trying to do this thing in that place. You let the model figure out the fact that these kinds of flows have a pattern which is okay and these other kinds of flows have a pattern which is bad. We are not there yet in the IoT case. We did prove it in this experimental case with the malware because it's a very nicely contained data set. But in other cases, this is where I think AI is going, where we give it enough information, enough data, and let it figure out the patterns such that the next time that somebody is away from the pattern, it recognizes it automatically and we can be proactive rather than reactive.
How can we use AI to remove the challenge of competitive advantage? If we look at bad actors, they don't particularly have an issue with working with each other, collaborating, sharing data, breaking a problem down into a dozen or two dozen steps, and individuals just contributing to that. But when we look at security companies, everybody wants that little edge to themselves. They don't really want to give away too much data because we're all competing for the same money at the end of the day. Does AI offer a potential here for removing the competitive advantage by enabling the AI engines from different vendors to talk to each other, to do a degree of deep data sharing that gets us much closer to the type of sharing that we see from bad actors.
Let me first say that I disagree with your original claim that in the bad world, the bad actors are very happy sharing things with each other. I'm not going to quote any statistics on this, but I think that's not as much as there because of the fact that they are often afraid that some of them are moles. And hacking is often a very well-contained small affair. At the same time, the security industry, even in spite of all the competitiveness, has done rather well in sharing information. For example, VirusTotal, and there are other similar things where people collaboratively share the knowledge, and you basically do it for bragging rights. No one makes any money from VirusTotal, but you just get bragging rights, and that actually incentivizes people into sharing information. So I'm saying the problem is actually a little bit skewed on the other side than what you said. Having said that, can we use AI such that people can really share data in the thing? My short answer is I'm pessimistic, because if you are building an AI system like I am and my team is, you spend 80-90% of your time wrangling the data just to be able to fit it into your model. And to have a really systematic way of sharing data so everybody can build their models against is a bit of a unicorn. It's really hard. So yes, I am pessimistic. In theory, it sounds great, but I'm pessimistic that you can have a really comfortable way of sharing the data such that different people can share their AI across them. It's just, we're not there yet. I wish we were, but we are not there yet just in terms of the tools and the things available.
What does the future hold for AI in cybersecurity specifically?
I think security is the greatest challenge for AI, and AI is the best hope for security.
Manjushi, thank you for your time today.
You're welcome. It was great talking with you.